Welcome back to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Centre. For this episode, we're going to hear from French academic and journalist Frédéric Martel about sex and hypocrisy in the Vatican. Here's our host, Sally Warhaft.
It's just a total pleasure to be here tonight with you all and with our guest, Frédéric Martel. And Frédéric has arrived today from Paris. He just couldn't wait to be here. So we're so fortunate to have him here for the only event that he's doing in Melbourne. Frédéric is a researcher, a writer, a journalist, an academic, the author of 11 books, including The Pink and the Black on Culture in America, Mainstream and Global Gay. Frédéric anchors a weekly radio program on French National Public Radio, and he is the reporter at large for Slate in France, among many other things that he does. But he's here tonight to talk to us about his latest book, and Metropolis will be selling it, and Frédéric will be autographing it afterwards, In the Closet of the Vatican, Power, Homosexuality, Hypocrisy. So let's give him another warm welcome. Frédéric, I thought we could start with just to get to know you a little better in the context of taking on a book like this. And you write in the book, "I'm not Catholic. I'm not even a believer, although I measure the importance of Catholic culture in my life and in the history of my country." I was just wondering if you could speak to that a little bit about where you place yourself in having taken on a book like this, a project like this.
Bonjour à tous, ou bonsoir, ou bonne nuit, I don't know exactly. Yes, I mean, in France, the majority, actually the vast majority of people are Catholic by birth, or at least were. I mean, it's not the case anymore. We have 1.7%, which is basically nothing, of our population that goes to mass every week. So Catholicism is, let's say, dead. But we are still cultural Catholic in France, and the partial destruction of Notre Dame de Paris and the reaction of that shows that we don't believe in God, but we believe in God places in a way. And I would like to add immediately that, you know, for French, I know we are not the only one to think that way, but for French, the base of our system, the base of the constitution, the base of the main laws, and even from the French Revolution, there is a way we connect to religion in a very clear way. You have the right to believe, and we are in a country that protects believers. At the same time, we are also a country that allows people to criticize the religion. And quite often, as you might have known, we are very critical to Islam, and there is a lot of debate about Islamization and whatever. And the fact that a book like my book was also number one sale for 8 weeks in France, debated all over, means also that in France we don't just criticize Protestantism or Islam, but also Catholicism. And that's part of our identity, recognizing religion, but also be allowed to criticize it.
It's a book, obviously, about hypocrisy. I also read it very much as a book about fear, of tremendous sort of fear. But let's start with the hypocrisy. And you write...
Actually, the two things are related.
Ah, well...
Hypocrisy and fear.
Tell us more.
No, I mean, quite often people say, you know, how all these cardinals and bishops and priests can be gay because they are very homophobic and it's impossible because it's a contradiction. Actually, it is not. You are homophobic quite often, and especially in the church, because you're gay. Because you're gay, you're afraid that your homosexuality is known. And because you're gay, you prefer to play the homophobia game. And I think it works for a very large majority of cardinals, maybe even for some bishops and cardinals in Australia. Maybe.
It's possible.
Everything is possible.
Anything is possible. You write, never perhaps have the appearances of an institution been so deceptive. And you have a series of rules that come up throughout the book that you sort of emphasise about the closet, as you call it. And the third rule I'd like us to talk about. The more vehemently opposed a cleric is to gays, the stronger his homophobic obsession, the more likely it is that he is insincere and that his vehemence conceals something. The lady doth protest too much, methinks.
Hamlet, Act 3, I guess.
Tell us how you came to this conclusion based on your research.
You know, I have to be clear here about the fact that I'm not writing this book to denounce, nor even to out any cardinals or bishops. And by the way, the fact that a cardinal, bishops or a priest, and we might disagree on that, but for me, it's extremely clear, if they are gay, if they have a lover or whatever, that's not a problem for me. That's their life. And since I'm not a Catholic, the only thing that is important is the law. If it's allowed by the law, it's okay for me. So the fact that a cardinal will have a lover, I'm fine with that. And by the way, I prefer that than he touch a kid of 10 years old in the presbytery. So that's the basic things of my book. Second of all, I think the question is not about Cardinal A or Bishop B or Priest C. The question is about a sociology. And to answer your question, I need to go back on the reason why so many religious people in the Catholic Church are gay, and much more that you think, and probably much more than I say in my book. I think I'm under the reality, and also because, of course, there is a legal issue and just moral issue. You don't want to attack people, so you play down a few facts. When you are 20 years old, okay, not today, but in the 50s, in the 60s, basically 60 years ago, 70 years ago, and you discover you're gay. At that time, it was not gay. You didn't even use this kind of word. And you didn't even know you were gay. Maybe you didn't want to marry. You didn't like girls or these kind of things. And people, your friends in the university were making fun of you because of your voice, because of your clothes, because of the way you were, you know, not interested in girls, whatever. Your life in a little village in Italy or in a big city like here, in Melbourne, or also, let's say, in a bourgeois family in Paris, would be a nightmare, would be a disaster. And you understand that very early on. So becoming a priest was one of the main solutions. Basically, suddenly, becoming a priest, you can live only with men. You can use the clothes you want. You can sing with the voice you have in the choir. And the problem of your homosexuality became, in a way, a strength. And your mum, by the way, your mum, she understood everything. And she was so happy by this marvelous sudden vocation. So to understand the people in the church, in the Catholic Church, and even some Pope and the majority of the cardinal of today, you have to go back in the 50s, in the 60s, because they are 80 years old today. So to understand their homosexuality, or at least their relation to sexuality, you cannot understand them with the words and the code of 2019. You need to use the code on 1945, for example, or 1950. That's, I think, a key element. So then, to answer your question, sorry for the digression, it's, I'm openly gay, I'm in the church, I visit people, I meet them, they know me. I stay in the Vatican for 4 years, going back and forth, visiting other countries to meet other cardinals and bishops. And step by step, I became a friend of many of them. I in the beginning, I was difficult to have contact. I used to rent an apartment on Airbnb in Rome. Then I was able to enter some official Vatican houses. Then I was allowed to live inside the Vatican in 3 different apartments with a cardinal, 1 archbishop, and then 1 priest, or the other way around. So then you meet people, you understand their life, you speak with them, you connect with them. There is also kind of seduction between you and them in a very basic and normal way, like 2 person, adult person. It's not about abuse or anything like that. But of course, there is a seduction, and they are gay for a large majority of them. Even though they don't necessarily discuss that publicly, they do in private, especially the priests. The priests, quite often, the gay priests in the Vatican, when they know you, they speak about their homosexuality. And the gay cardinal also speak a lot about homosexuality, but mainly of other cardinals, never about themselves.
There's just a remarkable degree of openness, though, that you...
Not
you know,
that much.
...claimed. Well, it read to me that it was almost as if you became the priest and they were confessing, that they had somebody to talk to. I mean, they presumably knew you were a writer.
Yes, of course. I never lied on my name, on the fact that a writer, journalist... many of them knew I was writing a book. Some of them knew it was about homosexuality in the Vatican. Not all of them, because you need to have different strategy, different time or so moment. Yes, but I don't like the word confession, because I think, to go on this little point, I mean, confession is an aberration. You have priests, and they are supposed to be celibate, you know, chaste, whatever. And you ask them to ask kid about, like, sexuality? That's the base of the confession. You go to see a priest, and the priest is going to ask you, did you masturbate yesterday, or these kind of things? I mean, how can we allow that? That's the beginning of the problem. Asking a priest to ask question to a kid or even to an adult about secret behavior, that's totally insane. And that's the beginning of the abuse, to some extent. The first point we should say immediately is that a priest cannot ask any kid about any sexual content or question. That's the basic of the first reform we need to do in the church.
I want to ask you about what you sensed, you know, goes on in the you know, the hearts and the lives of all these men living this double life, living lives of untruthfulness, what they expressed to you about it, or if they did.
You said that very well in the beginning. It's about hypocrisy, but it's also sad. It's also, I mean, these people... I do believe the vast majority of the cardinals and bishops are gay. But when I say gay, it's a lot of gayness. I would say it's LGBTP, you know, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender priest. Yes, that's a new acronym that I just invented, LGBTP. And no, but to be more serious, you have, first of all, a large number of them that are what I call, and it's not my word, it's an old word, homophile. An homophile, we used this word in the 50s, in the US, in UK, in France. It is basically an homosexual. I think it's an homosexual because he has, his culture is gay, his psychology is gay, even the fact that he's homophobic is because he's gay, but he doesn't act. So he's chaste. So in a way, the priest is totally faithful to his vows of chastity or celibacy. And that's an important category, I think, in the church. Then you have people that just have a normal gay life. They have a lover. They are very quiet with that. Sometimes they might be ashamed, and especially when they are were young or whatever. I mean, I spoke to many of them that were in trouble. You know, they met somebody, they had sex or whatever, and then they became ashamed about that. And so they take weeks, months, sometimes years to ask for to be forgiven. For example, I met a priest. He's a bit younger, so he's not like a 80 years old cardinal. He's more my age, and he's very. I mean, he's not famous. You don't know him, but he's famous in the sense that he's extremely close to the Pope. And whenever the Pope is somewhere, he's with him, and you can see him on camera and photos. And so, I met him many times, and in general, he was like very, very friendly. He never said to me that he was gay, but I have a ton of text messages. He said, you know, Frederick, we can have dinner tonight. Come to pick me up in the apartment at 9 p.m. And, you know, just enter the apartment, I will be in the shower. So things were very clear, if you want. And you know, the guy is extremely, I mean, in danger. If I will publish the text message I have, and there is a ton of them, it will be fired immediately by the church, because you know, how can you write these kind of things all the time? And so, at the same time, he said to me one day recently, he said, you know, Frederick, in 2 years, we'll be over. I said, what will be over? I won't be what you think I am. So basically, he's not going to be gay anymore. How is that? So he has this very strange discussion with the saint he's believing in, and he has a very special things to do. So he doesn't eat meat, he doesn't a lot of. And then after these 2 years of sacrifice, he's not going to be gay anymore. So, of course, that's first of all impossible, and second of all, totally, insane again. And so after the book was published, he is in the book, but very, very little in a very nice way. So he said to me, thanks to quoting me in the book, and, you know, I know you, I accept with this sentence, I agree with you that you put this word, because I asked him for that. But at the same time, people now think I'm one of your source, which of course he is. I said, okay, I hope you're going to be all right, but don't worry. I'm not going to be against you. I'm not going to publish anything, and you can be sure I will protect you, but just between us. First of all, you're gay. If you don't know, I tell you. Second of all, you don't think there is a problem, somebody like you, very conservative, very homophobic, and as the same, so gay. You don't think we need to change the system one day? And I said, but once again, I don't judge you. And I'm not going to be mean to you in any way. But just think about that, love. And he sent me a message back, love.
Let's talk about Pope Francis. You describe him as you and many others, the most gay-friendly of the modern pontiffs. And I want to talk about this conversation he had on the aeroplane with the Brazilian journalist who asked him about a gay priest in a press conference sort of at the back of the plane and about 5 years ago, and his response was, "Who am I to judge?" And what that meant, how you read that, how you understood it, but also perhaps how the right of the Vatican understood that as well, what that particular quote meant, "Who am I to judge?"
To understand Francis, and your question is very good because that's really a turning point to some extent, I just need to go back to the three previous popes very quickly. First of all, Paul VI. Paul VI, so we are in the 70s, and he lives in a very homophile world. He might have been himself an homophile, and his entourage was extremely gay but homophile. Some were actively gay, like Archbishop Marcinkus, people like that. But it was a time when things were kind of not really known, and the words were not put on the what people were doing. Then you have Jean-Paul II. Jean-Paul II, who's probably straight, was extremely focusing on communism, as you know, on mysticism. He's the Pope of my youth, and I love him for what he did on communism, but also what he did on, you know, when he was suffering, he became the Pope of suffering, and I had a great and positive image of him. However, around him, the cardinal, bishops, and assistants were extremely actively gay, and many of them, actually, if you take the 14 more important cardinals, bishops, and assistant of Pope John Paul II, among the 14th, more than half of them are gay. And two or three of them were using prostitutes all the time. So that's a very incredible story, given who is Jean-Paul II. I think Jean-Paul II didn't really know what was going on around him. I think he was already old and already sick in the beginning of the 90s. And the way he was so obsessed by communism and his priorities, which I agree with or I understand, made him not seeing some problems. And the problems are big.
Well, he also, though, was just obsessed with prohibition of condoms, of any sort of artificial contraception, the strict obligation of celibacy. You yes. Describe Jean-Paul II as the that with his arrival, there was a veritable war was waged against gays.
Yes, and I think there is still both a contradiction and a mystery with him. He was also a fighter against theology of liberation, especially in Latin America. And what is very surprising is that all the cardinals he put in charge to fight against communism, many of them were gay, actively gay in Mexico, of course, in Colombia, Alfonso López Trujillo. It was the case also in Chile, some nuncios. So the story is still very unclear to me, but I give him the, let's say, I think he was naive and he was not aware because he was so obsessed by other things, too old, too sick, too early, then probably didn't know that, for example, some main advisor he had protected the most awful pedophile of the last 50 years. Marcial Maciel in Mexico, Fernando Caradima in Chile, Groer in Austria, to some extent the cover-up system of Bernard Law in the US, Ireland, and so on and so forth. So Jean-Paul II will be probably judged very badly in history because of that. But I still think he didn't know. I might be wrong, but I think his entourage knew very well. But I think he was probably they might not have given him the right information about that. If you take Benedict XVI or Joseph Ratzinger, that's another case. First of all, I think he's gay. I think he's an homophile. I never believed one second that he slept with the famous assistant Georg Ganschwein. I think that's fake. But I believe he is homophile in a way that is run by a problem that never been very clear in his life. And his homophobia is extremely homophobic, as the key explanation is that he's an homophile. But at the same time, he's very naive.
I have to stop you there, though, that's a key explanation. Tell us more, though, about why you would... Because there are plenty of homophobic people who, of course, aren't homophiles or homosexuals. What was it about Benedict that you singled?
You know, in the church, I don't agree with that. I think it's very clear. For me, there is a sociological rules. As much as you are homophobic in public in the church, as much as you are probably homosexual in private. When I met recently, I mean, a year ago, Cardinal Walter Kasper, it's a German cardinal, or Cardinal in Omela is a Spanish cardinal. I met him in Barcelona. When you speak with them about homosexuality, they are very clear. They say, okay, Frederick, I think gay marriage is a problem. I don't necessarily agree with that, but we need to give civil union to the gay people. I don't want to go to the street to demonstrate. I think we need to open the debate, but my position is this one, your position is that, we can debate, whatever. When you are in front of people like that, you understand that they are probably straight. They have a normal way of thinking. They might disagree with me, but we can discuss. Then you have other cardinals that are hysterical about homosexuality. That's the worst things in their life. They think about that from the morning to the night. They went to the street number one in line to fight against gay marriage. Then when you see this kind of people, you think, there is something wrong, guy. You are probably what you denounce. And that rule works, let's say, 99% of the case.
Francis.
Just to finish on Benedict, because I think Benedict was very naive, and among him, the system exploded. Many cardinals were in trouble because of sexual abuse, some of others because of cover-up. Cardinal Bertonin was incompetent. The rumors were everywhere, Vatilix won, the Beaufort story, many, many scandals. And he quit. And I believe he quit for... I mean, that's the most important decision of any pope as... taken for centuries. Mm. So when you take a decision like that, it's not just because of a small things. It's probably a big things and probably many big things. So health played a role, many other factors, the incompetence of Bertone, whatever. But the homosexuality series of scandals were, I think, the core of his decision as well. So then you have Francis, and Francis was elected in reaction to John Paul II and Benedict. This is why I needed to go back to them. The cardinal, even when they are homophobic, when they were gay or whatever, they understood that was not possible to go on in this system. Because when you have a pope that quit, when you have so many scandals, you need to change something. And to some extent, Francis, I would say, is the consequence of that. He's probably not... how do you say that in English? He's probably not gay, and he's probably, and for sure he knows extremely well what's going on in the Vatican. Much more than John Paul II, who was not hands-on on the subject, and much more than Benedict, who was very naive about that. Francis is not naive at all. He knows who is gay, what they do, how they organize themselves against, actually, him for a very special reason that they hate this pope. I mean about cardinals that are very conservative, very homophobic, people like Cardinal Brandmüller, Cardinal Mesmer, Cardinal Caffara, Cardinal Sara, Cardinal Burke, of course, Cardinal Müller as
Cardinal
well.
Pell.
And Pell. Pell was, I mean, still is an opponent of Francis. He is a very homophobic cardinal that believes marriage should be only between a man and a woman, no sex before marriage, no divorce, no homosexuality. And of course, like many others, that's the theory. And you...
Not going too well, is it?
I think it's a theory. And I will say the these cardinals that are very aggressive against Francis, they hate him because he's more liberal than them, because, of course, the migrant issue, because of the, you know, he's in favor of the poor people, because he's more close to theology of liberation to some extent. And basically the fight is a kind of reverse fight. To understand the fight, you need to see that it's counterintuitive. You have these very homophobic cardinals that attack a pope because he's gay-friendly when they are sometimes the gay one. So, you know, that's the story of the Vatican. But another word on Francis. When I began this work, I was not a big fan of Francis. You know, I'm French, and already for French, a Jesuit is a problem. He's an enemy, you know. Half of truth, half of lie all the time, you know, we don't like. And from Voltaire to Pascal, we have a long history of, you know, fight against Rousseau, against Rimbaud, against the Jesuit. And Francis is a Jesuit, is Peronist, which means Argentine nationalist, and 82 years old. For me, was not the definition of modernity of somebody that is very progressive. So I was not a very fond of him. And the sentence you mentioned, who I am to judge, is a complex sentence. It's a wonderful sentence, but it's also answering a question by a question. Who I am to judge? So we ask him a position and he answers by another question. That's typical of Jesuit. And in addition... and another point, and that's more detail, and it's I tell more that in the book, and it's a pretty long story. But in fact, he doesn't answer a question that is about gay people. He answers a question about a scandal that the press was attacking one of the priest that is very close to him, Monseigneur Rica, and I know him well because I lived in one of his house. And Monseigneur Rica was supposed to have been in Uruguay, where he was with a lover that was a military person from Switzerland. All that is public in the press. And then he was in a bar that might have been a gay bar. He was beaten. Some priests had to protect him. And then one night he went back in his house in the nunciature in Uruguay, and unfortunately it happens the elevator in which he was with a young man stopped and the police has to take him out in the morning with the firefighters or whatever, and of course it became a big scandal about Monseigneur Rica in Uruguay. So the Pope was asked by the journalist in the plane about the scandal, and he answered, who I am to judge Monseigneur Rica, not to judge gay people in general. But however, the sentence became something else. It became the most famous sentence of the pontificate, maybe the most famous sentence of Francis, and, you know, it became the symbol of his openness or on his progressi, how he became progressive. How do you say, progressist?
Progressive.
Or progressive, liberal, whatever. And that's basically the story of Francis.
How do you feel about him now? You said you started off...
Yes. When you see the way he's attacked by people like Pell, but also Müller, also Burke, you step by step sympathize with him. I mean, he might not have been my pope in the beginning, but when I see how he's under fire, under pressure, with this cardinal that lie all the time against him, you become to like him. And I became a fan of the Pope. And, you know, Pope Francis doesn't care about somebody being gay. And we are very sure about that. When he is in front of a cardinal, a priest that is gay, or even a gay person, not a religious one, he's fine with that. He has no problem with people being gay. However, his main target are the cardinals that are both gay and homophobic. And that's the problem for him.
Well, and that's the problem you share with him.
Yes.
What is he doing about it?
You know, what can you say? You know, there is... If you take this book has been in a debate for 3 months. It was published 3 months ago in thousands of articles everywhere in the world. And nobody basically said that's untrue. Some people have said, you know, you shouldn't have written that, or it's not true on this case or in these details, or there is insinuation, whatever. But nobody really disagree with the diagnostic because everybody knows it's true. So then when you have that, this book, what can you do? There is two ways to react. The first way is the extreme right. They say, okay, that's very simple. We are going to take the gay out. We are going to identify them. There is a gay lobby, whatever. We all of fire them. Then we are fine. There is no gay people in the church, and there is no sexual abuse. That's the theory of the extreme right. And that's totally fake for many reasons. First reason, if you take the gay out of the Vatican, there is nobody in the Cardinal College. And among the two last popes, there is maybe just one. And so that I don't think it's a practical solution. The second problem is that there is no such a thing as a gay lobby. A gay lobby will be cardinals that will know they are gay, that connect with other gay cardinals. They discuss the fact that they are gay and they want to promote gay subject and help the gay cause and do political activism for that. That's exactly the opposite we have in the Vatican. All these cardinals that are gay are lying about their homosexuality. They never share that with any other people, and they are very homophobic to lie about their homosexuality. So there is no such a thing as a gay lobby. There is something else, which is a vast majority of silent and shame.
The closet.
So the first hypothesis is, I would say, over, and that's not the hypothesis of Francis. The second one, with this kind of, I would say, diagnostic, is we need to change the rules if the reality is true, is this one. It means, obviously, open priesthood to women, obviously allowed priests to be married, and probably allowed them to be gay. Which, by the way, is already the case. So I don't think Francis had the power to do that. I don't even think he has... I mean, that's very difficult to know what the Pope wants, but probably he knows that step by step we need to go in this direction. But he knows also that it will take a long... It will be a long time and a long fight. And he tried to change little things, and he got a very harsh attack by the right-wing cardinals. So now his strategy is very simple. He's changing the cardinals, because fortunately, at 75, they have to quit, and at 80, they don't vote. Since all of them are between 70 and 90, if he survives 5, 7, 10 more years, the College of Cardinals will be different, and then another pope might do the big reform that's probably is willing but not able to do.
Let's talk about Cardinal Pell, because you met him, you interviewed him for the book, and in fact he was one of the very few sort of enemies of the Pope Francis who agreed to speak.
No. I met also many of them, Müller, for example. But he was a nice one, to tell you the truth.
You describe him He is standing, I am seated. Suddenly I have a giant in front of me, but a courteous, professional, concise and humorful giant. Tell us about that meeting and your perceptions of him then and since.
You know, when I interviewed him, he was Minister of Economics of Pope Francis, and I was already surprised that he got this position, because the rumors at that time, it was mainly rumors about what he did in Australia, were already extremely well known. So the Pope appointed him knowing that something was going on in Australia. By the way, on this subject, I'm more in favor of the Pope than many people, because I think that's important when you are not a judge, and I'm not a judge, and Francis is not, to some extent, a judge because of that at that time. You cannot decide instead of justice. So if you have a cardinal that has not been, at that time, he was not indicted, he was not guilty, convicted, how you are going to punish him without a justice decision? So I think the Pope might have done a mistake to appoint him at that position, but I think he was right not to fire him at that time. And it's very important to work that way, because if you begin to fire somebody without any proof by a decision of justice, then you act against people without a real fairness. And I would say Pope Francis, the way he acted on Pell, and it's the same with McCarrick, and the same with Barbarin in France, the same with Luigi Ventura and many others, is very simple. Until somebody is indicted, he doesn't act. When the person is indicted, he asks him to quit his position, but he's not fired. When the person is convicted, he is fired. So he really follow this kind of moments, and I think that's basically what he did in the Chilean cases, for example, which is also important, and we can go back on that later, and I'm much more familiar on the Chilean case, because that's a key gay issue and also a very complex, long story. On Pell, I cannot tell more, especially because tomorrow and the day after, you will have a new appeal. So what I mean, on the Pell cases, there is two things that are very different, as you know. There is the cases about covering up, and there is the debate about the kids that he might have rape. So the two things are already very different. And for me, even though in this case they might be with the same person, in general they are not. In the very large number of cases, the Marcel Maciel story, the Karima story, the Goer story, Karadima story, and so on, you have the priest that is an abuser, and then you have another cardinal or bishop that is protecting the abuser. But in general, they are not accused themselves of abuse. For example, if you take Bernard Law in Boston with a shame case, but in any case, Bernard Law never been accused of himself abusing kids. And that's the same for Angelo Sodano in Chile, for Stanislav Divic, who is now a cardinal in Poland, was the main personal assistant of John Paul II, and so on and so forth for many, many others. However, and I'm still speaking in a general terms here, many of the bishops or cardinals that protect an abuser are themselves homosexual. And then there is the key element of the system. And I need just 2 minutes to explain why it works like that. That's, I guess, the key of all the stories. And this is why my book, which is a book on homosexuality, is also, even though that's not my subject, a book on sexual abuse. How it works. Let me be clear, first of all, that there is no link at all between homosexuality and sexual abuse. And in the world, all the statistics we have are very clear about that. Sexual abuse are mainly heterosexual, and the victims are mainly girls and women. And they are mainly in straight family and in organizations like schools with girls. Why is that? Because the vast majority of the people in the world are heterosexual, and that's totally normal. There is much more cases of abuse that are heterosexual. That's the first point, and it's very important. Second of all, if we look at the statistic only in the Catholic Church, then we see that the victims of the abuse by priests are between 80 to 85% boys, underage boys, or men. For example, seminarians that are in general, all of them are adult. So there is a singularity of the abuse in the Catholic Church that are mainly homosexual abuse, if you want. So the question is, why? Why is that? I'm not a psychoanalysis. How do you say that in English?
Psychoanalyst.
Psychoanalysis. I'm not a psychiatric or whatever, and not a policeman or a judge, but what we know is that's first of all, it's not homosexuality the problem by itself. It's more a lie about sexuality in general, a deny about your own sexuality, a deny about sexuality that is very repressed, that is very sublimated. So you hate yourself. It's hate things. You lie to others about your sexuality, but you also lie to yourself to some extent. Second of all, and here we are in the core of the subject, there is a vast system of cover-up that is based on a culture of secrecy that has been created for a long time, but the main problem for the church was the sexual liberation. Because before sexual liberation, in a way, nobody was discussing that. Homosexuality was a crime or a problem everywhere in the world, so you had no dichotomy, no separation between the church and the world outside. Actually, the church was more a safe place for homosexuals. So the debate, I mean, if a priest had a woman, nobody will discuss that. So it was not something that really was a problematic for the church. After 68, after the 70s, under Paul VI, the gap became extremely big between the church in one hand and the society in the other end. People began to have sex with before marriage. They divorced in a large numbers. Homosexuality became visible. They were proud of being gay and so on and so on. For the church, was impossible. And they had to become even more closet on their sexuality rules to try not to have their secret becoming known. We believe today that the very vast majority of the priests have a sexuality. For example, in Bolivia, in little town in Mexico, in Africa, in Brazil, all the priests have a girlfriend in general, especially in rural area. They quite often even have a wife. Sometimes they are married. Two priests married them between themselves. They find, one is married a girl by the other one and so on. And in big city, they are more gay. So basically, the rule is very simple. Heterosexual sexuality for the priest in rural area, homosexuality in big city. In Mexico, it's very typical. Also in Chile, in Brazil, and I would say a bit everywhere. So then homosexuality for the cardinals and the bishops is a lie so strong that you try to protect this lie in a very, very deep way. And if suddenly you're a cardinal or a bishop and there is a problem in your church with a priest that is accused of sexual abuse, that's a huge problem, not just for him, but also for you. And because you're also with your secret, you cannot do anything. If the priest has a trial, if there is a scandal, if there is a mediatization, you are yourself in jeopardy. Many things can happen. Let's say, I am the bishop, I'm in front of the priest. The priest will say, you know, Frederick, it's terrible. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have touched this kid. I know it's wrong. I'm really sick. But you understand me. You live with Michael. And then this finish. The bishops cannot do anything. I don't even speak about blackmail. Blackmail also exists, probably. Then it's worse. If I say, you know, if you attack me, I will mention everything I know about you. But not even without doing that, just on a regular basis, the bishop, the cardinal, he feels guilty. He knows that that's not the same thing to be gay and to abuse a kid. But the church has put this confusion forever. If you listen to Jean Paul II, Benedict XVI, if you read any document for the church, that's always the same things. If you're gay, if you have sex before marriage, if you divorce, you are going to go to jail, to hell, and also to jail maybe, to hell without... So being an abuser, of course everybody knows it's worse, but it's still a crime in a way by the church standards. And sorry for my English, it should be a bit more precise and it's easier for me to say that in really French. But you got the point. And then there is a system where everybody controlling everyone and basically nobody is going to talk because everybody wants to protect themselves, first of all.
We are going to go to questions in a moment. So if you'd like to ask Frederick a question, please put up your hand, and while you're doing that, I want to ask you, because I feel this is a question that isn't asked very often, about what it means that the Vatican is its own state, you know, that it's not subject to the laws of Italy or anywhere, but what does that mean?
You know, you cannot be against that. I mean...
I'm not against it, but for example,
we have... When my book was published, the day before McCarrick, the Cardinal McCarrick, became defrocked, the day after Luigi Ventura, the nuncio in Paris, was accused of four adult men of abuse, and then you had Pell and Barbara and so on and so forth. So the way the system exploded, it's a bit incredible. And I was in the middle of this storm without knowing before. But to some extent, the church tried to protect it, and I think they are lost. Because there is no solution, and that's also the problem of the Pope. There is no solution of today. Either you don't do anything and it's going to be worse and worse, that's a dead end, or you try to change the system. And if you do it, it's a bit like Gorbachev when he began to change things. Then the revolution begins. All the revolution begins when you try to adapt the system a little bit. So, you know, I don't know what are the solutions.
Have you got a microphone in your hand? Oh, well, do not speak yet. Wait till there's one in there. We've got one up the... Yes, and then here. Thanks.
I just want to know why you won't apply your theory to Wojtyla, the most homophobic of Catholic spokespeople for the last 50 years. Perhaps not gay, perhaps not effeminate, but... certainly homosexual.
Yes, but, you know, I try to work on facts. And as far as I know for now, regarding the former Pope from Poland, Jean Paul II, we don't have any, not a beginning of a proof that he was interested by men. Paul VI and Benedict XVI, it's a totally different story, but I'm not going to invent a boyfriend when the only element we have are mainly women. So for me, that's just the reason why I think I cannot go further on John Paul II. And I believe he was straight. I mean, if we can say a priest or a pope is straight, but you know the point. You know the idea.
Gentleman there, put your hand up. Yeah, that's it.
Hello, my name is Kamal. I have a friend, actually, that used to date someone in Dubai, both male. And all of a sudden, he got his heart broken and decided to seek priesthood just because he got fed up of being gay and the gay lifestyle. My question is, these gay men seek priesthood because they hate themselves, they hate the gay life. And do you think like this is the reason why they seek priesthood? So they have so much hate, they don't like themselves, and you know, and because of the stance of the church on homosexuality, they seek protection maybe within the church to basically help them not be gay. So that's why it's even much more, you know, they become even more closeted. That's what I was...
Yes, I mean, the example you take, I mean, I have 10 letters every day right now about these kind of stories, and incredible stories. Sometimes it's like letters of 40 pages. I don't even have the ability, and sometimes it's in language I don't even speak. I agree with you and with your statement. I think it's very, very strong. However, I think every story is different. Becoming a priest, or because you're gay, or because you—that's a very complex way, in any case, and complex situation. So every case is very different. You have also people that didn't know. I mean, I believe some people that I interview said to me, "I became gay at 40." So I didn't know at all it was because I was gay that I became a priest. Some others are very clear. You know, yes, I'm gay. It was difficult. It's easier to be gay in a world of men. My mom was happy by that. It was my solution. I deal with that. And there is a lot of strange behavior. For example, I'm very surprised why in the Vatican the majority of the gay priests hate Francis. And they love Benedict, which is a big contradiction, because Benedict is a very homophobic and Francis is at least more gay-friendly than the other one. And then you understand step by step why. I interview them out for hours, and they say, you know, when you're gay and you're in the Vatican, you came there because it's a safe place. And when you're gay and you want to be in a safe place, it's very important that your system is not going to change. You want a system that is clear. You need to be homophobic outside, but inside you do whatever you want. Then that's fine. You're like a fish in his bocal, how do you say that? In his...
In a fish bowl, yeah?
Exactly. Fish in a fish bowl. And then you can swim and do your own stuff. Francis is arriving and is basically destroying all the system. He's changing everything. And so the gay people that are so afraid and so willing to be protected by the church are in panic mode. And because of that, they don't like this pope. They are so afraid that things can be wrong for them. This is why also some of them don't like my book. Because when you have somebody that comes and explains the reality of the system, my worst enemy are the gay priests. Because they know the system. They just don't want anyone to know it as well. So then the system is very complex, and you have all kind of... You have also, and I will add that, because that's the only statistic a bit sure that we have. A priest named Sipe, S-I-P-E, I think he's dead, but he's a priest and a sociologist, American, did a study about priesthood and sexuality a few years ago. That's a small number of priests, of course, very complex to do. But what he, the conclusion he has is that 10% are basically chaste. 10%. Then 50% have a regular sexuality, mainly with men and some with women. And then, and this is the most important point, 40%, the last 40%, are priests with extremely bad feelings and behavior about sexuality. Extremely immature and extremely in trouble. So the problem of sexual abuse is not the 10%, it's not even the 50%. It is this 40% that are totally immature.
Time for one more.
Bonjour, thank you for coming here. One quick question, how did you get all these people to talk to you, tell you your secrets, knowing, or some of them knowing that you are writing a book about it?
You know, I was attacked by the extremely right, especially in the US, and they said, you know, we know Pope Francis helped you. He asked, this is why you were able to live in the Vatican and even fund your book. Of course, that's not true. You know, that's the work of journalism. When you spend 4 years and you become friend with somebody. For example, the people I know the more are the ultra-conservative. You know, for example, I speak with Steve Bannon. That's not easy, but he's not a priest. But, you know, you need to become friend of them. You go with them sometimes in vacation. You live with them. For example, I used to live with my cardinal in the Vatican. And, you know, with the normal day, we say, okay, let's do a dinner tonight. So we went to the shop, we buy fish, we cook the fish together. And at night, we invite some people living in the house inside the Vatican to come for dinner. And then you have 10 people and we are making fun and we eat our fish. That's a gay dinner. And here you have the assistant, one of the assistant of Benedict, one of the assistant of Bertone, and I know them. And you're so different. You don't lie to who you are, but then you are in another world. You have a dinner, and then you create some. And of course, I have also many sources in the Vatican. Gay priests help me a lot. I work on archives. I work on diplomatic telegram. I ask the police. I work with the police. I interview 60 prostitutes. I work with the doctors for HIV. HIV is very important in the Vatican. Cardinal died by AIDS and so on. All these things are not known. So you work, it's a puzzle. You have all the pieces. So step by step, you have one piece, another one, and at the end the puzzle is complete.
You've said that a straight person couldn't have written this book.
Yes, of course. I mean, the question is why this book, if it's true and if it's so general, why this book never been written? The answer is, first of all, nobody would have written this book 10 years ago. Would have been impossible. Second of all, if you're Italian, if you look at the press, the publishing world, it would be very difficult to write a book like that. And my publisher, my first publisher is Italian, Carlo Feltrinelli, and we met, he's a friend, and we decided to do this book 5 years ago. But the first, when I began to speak with him, he said the first day, the rule is you are going to publish this book at the same time in Italian, but also in French, English, Spanish, because he didn't want to have it only in Italian. And if you are a Vaticanist, which means somebody that is a journalist working only in the Vatican, you write this book, your career is over. You lose your job. So this, and if you're straight, you don't have the code. You don't understand, you don't have the network. You know, when I see Cardinal B, for example, going to his apartment, he opened the door. I'm sorry to say, in 2 minutes, I know if he's gay or not. In 2 minutes. Because, you know, and that's a secret, please not repeat that. And, you know, I'm 50 years old, so for me it's a bit, I would say, to be honest, and it's very a secret. It's, of course, a bit more difficult for me to meet people, because I'm 50 years old, in gay clubs, for example. In the Vatican, that's very easy. You know, for me, it's like if I am still 20 years old, fresh meat. I know I'm not so young, but I'm still 30 years younger than these cardinals. Yes, I try. We tried Grindr. That's very easy. You put two Grindr in the two sides of the Vatican. You see how it works.
And on that note, I want to thank you all for coming tonight. Frederick, it's been a real pleasure, a real insight. Thank you for coming so far, all the way to Melbourne. And
that's far away.
I know, right? It's a long way, but you know, troubles are everywhere. You know, pleasures are everywhere.
Exactly.
Enjoy our city. Enjoy your time in Australia. Once again, please thank Frederick Martel. Thank you.
Frederick Martel and Sally Warhart in front of a live audience at the Wheeler Centre on Tuesday, the 4th of June, 2019. This series comes to you via the Wheeler Centre, Melbourne's home for conversations about books, writing and ideas. Check us out at wheelercentre.com. Until next time, take care.